Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, I wonder how many languages you think are spoken in Australia. 20, 50, 200? It's about around 400. But do you know how many of those languages are native to Australia? It's thought that before Europeans arrived, there were up to 700 or so traditional languages spoken by hundreds of thousands of Aboriginal people across the country. Sadly, not the case anymore. Some say many of those languages are lost forever. Others describe those languages as being dormant and believe they can be woken up once again. The 2016 census found that 650,000 people identified as Indigenous Australians, but only about 10% spoke an Indigenous language at home. The United Nations declared 2019 as the International Year of Indigenous Languages. So what's being done to try and preserve language and encourage more people to learn them? We may be familiar with Aboriginal words like kui and barramundi, waratah, kangaroo. How hard is it to revive an entire language if there aren't any more fluid speakers? Well, we'll explore it and love your questions as well to join the conversation. Two experts who can shed some light on this are Professor Jacqueline Troy, who's a linguist at the University of Sydney and has been on the program before. Jacqueline, good evening to you.
Nice to be on again.
Lovely to have you back in. Dr. Rachel Henry is a linguist at the University of Western Sydney, co-curator of a new exhibition that celebrates Aboriginal languages as well. Rachel, terrific to have you on as well.
Nice to be here, thanks.
Terrific. Yeah, we'll just get you to move a little closer to that microphone and then we'll pick you up loud and clear. What do we know, Jackie, about the type and prevalence of Aboriginal language before European settlers arrived? Because the thing is, we did know a bit more about Aboriginal people when white settlers first arrived than we knew later, didn't we? What do we know about it at the time?
Well, when the first fleet arrived in 1788, they actually arrived with a word list from far north Queensland that they attempted to use with the...
Really?
Yes, they attempted to use with the local population who were utterly confused.
Where'd they got that from?
When Cook came to the east coast of Australia in 1770, he careened his ship up at what's now called Cooktown and picked up a word list there that his officers wrote down.
Is that right?
Yes, that was passed on to Philip to use. So he was using Kukulyalanji, which is a completely different language from a similar family to the languages widely across Australia. We've got two big groups in Australia called Parmenyungan and non-Parmenyungan, so they're related languages. But this was particularly the word kangaroo, which we now have as our general word for macropods in Australia, actually comes from that language far north. But the original first fleeters picked up a lot of local language for all the different macropods after they got over the shock of discovering that the list was wrong and kangaroos weren't the only words.
That would have been quite funny, wasn't it?
Because the Aboriginal people thought that sheep were kangaroos. So there's quite a lot of confusion around the word kangaroo.
Aboriginal people around Port Jackson when Philip arrived with the Gadigal people, what was their word for kangaroo?
Well, there were many. So Bajigarung, for example, was a small grey kangaroo. Mm-hmm. There were other words for like the word wallaroo that we now have in... We lost the word Bajigarung. People used to use that. But now the word wallaroo for that sort of heavier set macropod, dark furred one, wallaby.
About your eastern grey kangaroo?
Was Bajigarung. That was
the Bajigarung.
Yeah, that's right. And so the first fleeters fairly quickly picked up a lot of local language for plants and animals and the landscape and people's names and things, but those unfortunately have gradually disappeared from Australian English, the developing new form of English in Australia. Mm. And we're left with a residual group, but we've still got words like wallaby and wallaroo and wombat.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting though, isn't it? The word kangaroo, which everyone thinks would be a fundamental word understood by every Aboriginal person in Australia, is in fact not at all. It's a word that's taken from one language in North Queensland.
That's right.
This is something, of course, that they didn't understand at the time when they arrived, did they? And in fact, many people today probably don't quite understand either that the languages of Australia were quite distinct, that although Aboriginal people probably well, it probably invariably spoke more than one language because they would have contact with other people. It's not the case at all that someone from Queensland could necessarily converse with someone from Western Australia.
No, there's a lot of very similar things in the languages. For example, things that don't change, like body parts. Mm. All across Australia, the word for hand is something like mara.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other, you know, quite a lot of other common words and also pronouns and things like that. But the local language around plants, animals, artefacts, the ceremonies people conducted, the things specific to a local area would change, of course.
Yeah, interesting. The relationship between Aboriginal languages, the way that Aboriginal languages work also is different to the way, for example, English works. I mean, look, speakers of other languages probably already know this concept that, you know, there are two forms of the verb to be in Spanish, for example. In Aboriginal languages, there are often a number of genders too, other than male and female. There's a reading that one, there is a language where there's a gender that refers to edible plants, for example. That's a whole gender on itself. So the grammar can be also quite different around the country as well, can't it?
Well, they're as I said, they're in two sort of broad family groups, but the way our languages work are very different, as you've just pointed out, to English. And fundamentally what we have is a base form, if you like. So there'll be a verb, loosely what we'd call a verb, and then you add on to it things that tell you who did what to who, where and when and how. So they're what we call polysynthetic. They add things onto a base. So you can say a lot with one Aboriginal word, if you like. So in English, we're very wordy, but in Aboriginal languages, we're a lot less wordy.
Is that right?
So Naja Bawa means, and I saw you then, in the language of the Sydney area.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had to say that as a longer sentence in English than Naja Bawa.
Was there much attempt to learn it in the early colonial period?
Again, Philip arrived with a set of instructions that his officers were to learn the local languages, to conciliate the natives, to accept that the British invasion was going to be a really good thing for everybody, British and Aboriginal. So they were instructed to learn the languages. And unfortunately, in most of the First Fleet diaries, you see the officers saying, well, unfortunately, the local Aboriginal population is much better at learning English than we are at learning their languages. And so very quickly, a new kind of language began to develop. And it was a mixture of all the languages in the colony. In my own research, I called it New South Wales Pidgin, which was the beginning of the Creoles, which Rachel also has a very strong interest in and experience with studying. But these languages were literally a mixture of, including a lot of Irish. A lot of the first convicts were Irish, and a lot of them were not English-speaking. They were Irish-speaking, Gaelic speakers. So this kind of new language where you had multiple people who couldn't speak to each other in any one language developed out of this wonderful linguistic mix that was Sydney.
When we use words like Creole and Pidgin and so on, what are we talking about, Rachel?
Well, a lot of the time when people say Pidgin, they really mean what a linguist would call a Creole. So in sort of general speech, people will use Pidgin to refer to any kind of mixture of language. But from a linguistic perspective, we tend to talk about Pidgins as temporary languages that develop for a particular purpose. So, for instance, if you've got trading happening between two communities who don't share a language, then people have to find a way to talk about the things they want to trade. And they'll come up with simplified version of the language just for trading. That's a very common scenario in which a pidgin develops.
Although sometimes it becomes quite substantial, doesn't it? I mean, as I understand, in PNG, for example, pidgin's a widespread official language.
Well, that's what I mean about people using the word pidgin when a linguist wouldn't use it. So a linguist wouldn't say that Tokpizin, spoken in PNG, is actually a pidgin. Linguists would say it's a Creole, and the difference is...
Okay, then you're going to explain this.
I am going to explain this, yeah. Hope you don't mind. The difference is that a Creole is when it's spoken by children in the next generation, and then it becomes a fully fledged language because kids growing up need to be able to talk about anything and everything and they regularise things that were maybe mistakes that their parents were making when they were speaking a pidgin. And so that's when it becomes this expanded thing that's a real language. That's when we call it a Creole from a linguistic perspective.
Hmm. So English itself is actually possibly what we would call an expanded Creole, because it's such a mixture of so many other languages.
Well,
so,
because it's a mixture of Latin and there are Latin words, and there have been
points in time where in England, what we now call England, there was such a mixture of people coming in that, you know, some linguists like myself who are Creolists would argue that English is in that kind of mix. And we've now got English has gone beyond even a Creole stage to being a language that is so expanded that we modern English is probably wouldn't be defined as a Creole, but it's a post-Creole continuum to use linguist terms again.
Mm. So, how many Aboriginal languages are actively spoken today, Rachel?
Well, if you look at what was said in the census in 2016, only around 13 Aboriginal languages are spoken by children, so still being actively acquired by children in a community.
Mm-hmm.
However, census data is always problematic. You don't know exactly what people are going to say in a census, what they consider to mean. They're teaching it to their children, whether it's spoken in the home and so on. You don't know who exactly is answering the census. So we really can't be 100% sure, but certainly it's far, far fewer than the hundreds that were spoken at the time of invasion.
Mm. Is it growing or not?
Well, I would say that what's happening is that there's a big movement across Australia to renew the languages that have become dormant, wake them up and get them going again, and in the process also turn them into languages that we can use now for every possible purpose. So if you want to be a rocket scientist in Wiradjuri, the Wiradjuri community in central New South Wales, whose language was really getting quite dormant about 30 years ago, is now so active that there are thousands of school students every year learning Wiradjuri in Wiradjuri country. So some of them are likely to be rocket scientists, and if they want to talk about it in Wiradjuri, then they will. So all across Australia, we've got this wonderful movement to get our languages going again.
Mm. Yeah. Where is the area in Australia where it's densest in that sense, Rachel?
Well, it's a hard question. In terms of densest, in terms of actually languages surviving over a long...
That is where Indigenous languages are most active.
Yeah, Northern Territory, for sure, but that's a large region.
Mm.
But I think what Jackie was talking about in terms of the language reawakening and revival and so on, there's a lot going on even in New South Wales and places where the traditional, you know, retained languages, it's not dense, but this active working on working towards having community speaking the language again is extremely vibrant.
Mm.
And we would say as Aboriginal people that, you know, what's happened is that this sort of shift where from the north, where all these languages that have had probably the most recent invasion of their countries, so they've been less affected by people coming in and forcing them to stop speaking their languages. Those languages are in some ways not as likely to have a good future as our languages in the southeast and the southwest of Australia, where the language revival or renewal, I'm using the word renewal because it has a kind of religious character about it, it's not like a revival church. But, so it's very much, you know, we're renewing our languages. So we have got this urge to keep our languages going, whereas up north people want to keep their languages going, but because they still speak them, there's not quite the same urgency around it. So, you know, you can come from a language of 20 million people, as one of my colleagues at Sydney University does, who's Saraiki from Pakistan, and his language is likely to disappear in the not too distant future because it's so devalued.
Mm.
Whereas my language, where there are almost no speakers of Narigu, probably no speakers, we're just in a kind of renewal mode, so we're beginning to get a few speakers. We're going to speak our language again. That's all there is to it.
Mm.
The snowy mountains will hear our language. Gunama Namaji will hear our language again. And that's what we want to do. So we're not going to let it go. So there's a... How languages go out of use is always a tricky business, and I think that this great enthusiasm across Australia to keep our languages strong and get the ones that have gone to sleep woken up again is a pretty significant effort.
I said at the start that there were maybe 700 languages. We're guessing, aren't we? Because we don't really know. And how many Aboriginal languages have been described, even if they're not spoken?
I mean, I really love this way that everyone wants to quantify numbers of languages. It's such a hard thing to do, partly because what is a language? How do you define two different varieties of speech as two languages or one language? From a linguistic point of view, well, it's not really a linguistic definition, it's a political definition.
Isn't a language just an actual definition? Because a language is a distinct system of grammar, for example, the distinct vocabulary, isn't
it? Classically, we say if two groups of people are speaking something that has, less than 60% shared vocabulary, they're speaking separate languages because the ability to understand each other is going to be
limited,
very limited. So that's as Rachel's saying. But
you look at somewhere like, say, Western Europe, you can go from the very south of, say, Switzerland, right north to the tip of Denmark, and at each village along the way, each two villages will share almost all their vocabulary. People will understand their neighbours. But if you take people from the north of Denmark and people from the south of Switzerland, they do not understand each other. So do you talk about that then as a variety of separate languages? Do you talk about it as... We just tend to define it politically. We say Denmark, Danish is Danish because it's in Denmark, and German is German because it's in Germany.
Why is this so? I know this is probably a big question. Why is this so? Why didn't all of us, given that there's a common need to understand. Why didn't we all decide to learn the same language?
Well, in Australia, it's from the point of view of Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islanders as well. The reason why we've got these, I guess I would probably be a bit more hardline and say they are separate language. There are certainly separate languages, and there are at least 400 separate. There are 400 systems that are separate enough that we would call them separate languages
with separate vocabularies.
The vocabulary is what really separates them, because as I said before, there's a lot of shit. So if you learn, say, my language, Narugu, and you want to speak to the Sydney mob in their language, which has got lots of names depending on the clan group, but the language of the Sydney area, you wouldn't be able to converse it's like the situation with Switzerland and Denmark. But it's we split because we want to be different. So it's a socio-political choice that people make, and it takes about 3,000 years or so for a new language to develop from dialectal variation, as we say. So
that long?
It takes a long time, because it's not just one day people say, right, I'm not speaking to them ever again. Those Wiradjuri over there, we Narugu, we don't speak to them. We're going to change our language. It takes a long time. So to change the vocabulary. But there's always going to be a whole lot of things, like in my country, when you're talking about the local plants, they are alpine. They're nothing like the plants you find in central west of New South Wales. They might be part of the same kind of family of plants, because Australian plants all belong to very similar families, but they're alpine rather than western plants.
Given Aboriginal notions of country and belonging and so on, are the languages of Aboriginal Australia indelibly associated with that country?
Absolutely. Well,
absolutely. I mean, we that's one of the reasons why these languages develop separately is because we see ourselves as part of the country, and that we're so much a part of the country we can't be separated from it. Doesn't mean we don't own the country. People often say, Aboriginal people say that the land owns us. Well, that's certainly how we think, but we also know we own the land. So the British were quite wrong in thinking we weren't landowners, and that's becoming clearer all the time. But
it was very convenient for them to think that, wasn't it?
Exactly. And so, but people have all their totems, the things that are their symbols of themselves personally, but also of their clan groups, family groups, are derived from features of the country. So some people even have what we call sickness country dreamings and totems. So some people might have scabies as their... not everybody has cute, fluffy animals like koalas as their totem. So, every aspect of our country is honoured with some kind of connection that we have to it.
James in Albany has just texted me saying that Maori's interesting because the reason it's an official language in New Zealand is because the Maori were not in New Zealand as long as the Indigenous Australians were here. I'm not sure whether that's right or not. And the Maori only had a single language by the time of European settlement, largely single. Not true?
No, that's not true. There were at least five or six Maori languages. But I think what it's back to Rachel's point about politics. Maori certainly were not in what we now call New Zealand for anything like the length of time Aboriginal people have been. We've been, the latest estimates are, could even push it back to 120,000 years, certainly 65, probably 72, and possibly 120,000 years, which means that it starts to get a bit academic about whether we walked out of the Rift Valley or we walked from here to the Rift Valley. I don't know, but in Africa. So, but
it's a fascinating other discussion. All of that, which we have explored here on the program. Rachel.
I was just going to say it's absolutely true, though, that there are some really important differences between the New Zealand situation and the Australian situation in terms of language revitalisation, in terms of official languages and so on. And it does make things an awful lot easier and simpler in New Zealand that you don't have anywhere near the number of languages that you do in Australia.
Yeah, but you see, I would, as an Aboriginal person, I would disagree. I don't think there's a problem with having 400 official languages.
I don't think there's a problem with that either. I mean, more in terms of things like, for instance, if you're going to make street signs and have everything bilingually named, then it's more of a job in Australia. I'm not saying they shouldn't do it. I think absolutely it's important.
Except that you would, it's easy because we're all these little countries within the bigger country. So if you're in my country, call the mountain Gunamanamaji instead of Kosciuszko. Have all the street signing in Narragu. And do all the geographical features.
How do you know what the vocabulary of your language is, Jackie, when it hasn't been spoken for a long time? I mean, is it? How do you know what the words are? Was it ever written down?
Yes, yeah. And back to my point about our language is similar to other languages in our family group, the Pamanyungan family group. I can predict a whole lot of things about my language. So I can predict its grammatical structure and how it will work. I can predict a lot of the pronoun forms, a lot of things like body parts. But there are some quite good word lists from my country that were documented as early as the 1830s. And in fact, recently I've been reconstructing a song of the Monero district that was documented in 1834 with my colleague Linda Barwick from the School of Music as part of our corroboree project, where I'm going to be able to sing a song of my country again, and it looks like it's a snow increase ceremony song. Not surprising, given that it's snowy country.
Jackie and Rachel, to you both, we use Aboriginal words in English, but given the length of time that the Aboriginal language has been here, the borrowings don't seem to have been very great. Do you think so? Is that not true, or what do you think?
Well, it's not surprising to me, given the nature of the contact situation here. So in cases of invasion, when a group comes into a country and has substantially more power and takes over and destroys people and commits genocide, it's not usually common that that group then borrows a lot of vocabulary from the people that they are pushing out. You see the same thing in England, for instance, when we don't have that many words in English that are borrowed from the Celtic languages compared to later borrowings from Latin or from the French.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking that whites, when they came here, though, would have... I mean, the country's unfamiliar. I mean, there's a whole lot of plants and trees and all sorts of things which they don't know the names of. I mean, they would have asked somebody.
Those are the domains where we do get the borrowings, though. We get them in plants and animals and other things that were unfamiliar to people. Not in every case, because in some cases people just made up their own terms or they used a prototype of something they did know back home, like a magpie, for instance. The Australian magpie is not the same as the European magpie.
Except the really interesting thing that I've found, so my own doctoral work many years ago was looking at this sort of first contact situation through to about 1920, Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal people sort of trying to talk to each other one way or another. And I was mentioning earlier that we had a lot more of, say, the local vocabulary from Sydney used in what was the beginning of Australian English at the start. And that starts to disappear in the early 19th century. And I think it's possibly because not so much the destruction of our own people, because if, of course, we're not all that destroyed, we're still here, but it's because the landscape itself had changed so much. So the knowing the diverse terms for different kinds of macropods, for example, was no longer useful. So it's curious to me why the word kangaroo came back into use when everybody in the early Sydney period realised they'd made a mistake and were using a word from North Queensland. So we now broadly in Australia use the word from North Queensland. I'm not absolutely certain why that happened, but we lost all the diversity of knowledge that was in the earlier form of Australian English. The other thing that went on is that people swapped names. Every First Fleet officer had the name of an Aboriginal person, because that's how Aboriginal people also incorporate people into their communities. That's how we do that. We share naming. So that disappeared as well. So I think that what happened more than anything is that it was a sort of slow creep of a whole new way of being and living in a completely changed landscape. So, and you do get a greater diversity around local use of Aboriginal vocabulary in areas where the Aboriginal languages remained stronger. So if you go into the Northern Territory, for example, you'll find in a lot of territory English dialects, if you like, variations of Australian English, people know a lot of the local terms, and they even use terms for quite sacred things like Drukapa, for example. People know who live around Central Australia that that's the word for secret, sacred, important Aboriginal knowledge, Drukapa.
What about the wildlife of Australia? Because, I mean, that must have been one of the things that people wanted to know names of immediately. Yeah. We've talked about kangaroo. What about the platypus? Is that an Aboriginal word?
No. So, it comes from platyhelminth, meaning whatever it means in scientific. Duck-billed something or other.
But, you know, but of course, Aboriginal people would have had a word or words for this odd... odd-looking animal.
And again, as I said, those words were originally used, but they've gone out of use. So it's partly because, you know, the platypus, for example, is not something that most people encounter. We know about them, but in the wild, most Australians have probably never seen
one. What
about
koala? Is that an Aboriginal word?
That's an Aboriginal word, meaning basically not to drink. So from the word gula, water, gulara, not drinking. So
wombat?
Wombatch is a Sydney word, wombat. So,
we've talked about goanna, haven't we?
And waratah, you know, the great national flower of Australia, waratah is a Sydney language word.
That's an Aboriginal word.
So a lot of the vocabulary in broader Australian English has come from the Sydney area where those first encounters happened. And there was a lot of exchange of knowledge and a lot of communication, but... The difficulty is that the things that were really, I guess, elevated into importance on a daily basis have remained in our language.
Mm. All right, you're right, Rach. I thought you wanted to weigh in there. Let's take a few calls. 1-300-800-222 is the number. There's a lot of two free if you want to grab one. Graham, you've lived in Bali for a while.
That's correct, Philip. Yeah.
Yeah, hi.
And hi, ladies.
Hello.
Hi.
I noticed there's a common girl's name in Bali, which is Noongar, and I wonder if there's any connection with a Noongar tribe in Australia.
Highly unlikely.
Okay.
The thing about a word like that is those are really common sounds in the world's languages. Most languages have a vowel that sounds like "uh." A lot of them have a consonant that sounds like "ng." So, and it's a short word. It could really easily be coincidence.
Okay, thanks very much for that.
No worries. No worries. John, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
The comment I was going to make was the fact that you look at, say, Sydney and Melbourne, just in modern-day language, there are Europeans settled /invaded Australia 200 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
In Melbourne and Sydney, there are different words for different things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, cozzy, togs, schooners, pints, It's all different where you go.
Mm-hmm.
Now you look over a 40,000 or an 80,000 year period, the people in Darwin are not going to interact with the people in Sydney. The people in Sydney are not going to interact with the people in West Australia, and the language has time to develop.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you're talking about New Zealand, and I mean New Zealand was settled after the Magna Carta was signed. So New Zealand is like the newest country in the world in terms of settlement.
Newish.
Newish, because, I mean, you look at, say, the current thinking is that the French Polynesians came over in about the late 13th century, and prior to that, there was nothing. And the Maoris didn't have that 40,000 years to develop their own language, and as I said, like Sydney and Perth with Cossies and Togs and all of this, you're getting regional differences as people adapt the language. Because, I mean, you even look at the youth of today, the expressions they use are different to what we might have used in the 1970s, 1980s. So I can understand the Australian Aborigines having a lot of different languages for the same things, because over that length of time, they're being isolated from other groups within Australia. Because, as I said, the only way to really get around Australia is to walk. And you're not going to get people from Darwin interacting with people from Sydney. So the language development is going to be different.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, yeah, I guess that's probably true, isn't it?
And I
think that's why New Zealand it probably doesn't have that language diversity, because prior to European invasion, they really only had like a 300-400 year period.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think that, you know, Rachel, you were making that point earlier too.
That's absolutely right. Although I would say that there were some pretty epic journeys made by Australians, and we have records, oral records, and also later written records of some extremely long journeys. So even though people were walking around, there was definitely contact of different parts of the country.
Absolutely, I don't doubt that. But I mean, they wouldn't be. I wouldn't have thought that on a regular basis there was that thing enough to influence the language.
That's right. Well, so neighbouring languages.
There's also evidence now that suggests that the modern Australian languages are likely to have arisen in what's now called Far North Queensland about 6,000 years ago. So, you know, and this big group called Parmenyungan spread from there.
Okay.
But also, we had contact 6,000 to 10,000 years ago from people from what's now called South Asia, so the area of Pakistan and India. So, you know, we were never completely isolated. That's a pretty important thing to remember. And we don't
particularly across the top.
Yeah,
the top
well, no, it's been ongoing.
Across the whole country, really, because people, you know, didn't just stop when they hit that. I mean, the land mass was different back then. The sea levels were different. And so people didn't just stop when they got to the top.
But there's been ongoing contact between Papua New Guinea and Northern Australia, between the Pacific and Cape York. I mean, those have always been trading routes.
Georgina says, platypus is derived from the Greek, Phil, which is something you're making. You're saying, Jane. Well, would be interesting to know what the animal is actually called in the native Aboriginal language. Well, here we go. Because which language are we talking about, I suppose?
Yeah.
What is it in your language? Do you have a word for
it? I don't know. And there certainly are platypus up in the Snowies. But and I should know, and I think it's on our word list. And, this is how new our revival movement is. Renewal of Narragu is.
Peter, hello.
Hi, Phil.
G'day.
I've just driven home from the State Cinema in Hobart, where the Tasmanian premiere of the Australian movie The Nightingale has just been shown. And the lead actor, Blakely, he's a man from East Arnhem Land, speaks the Tasmanian language Palawakani in the lead role for the first time ever in a feature film.
That's wonderful. Okay. That's been a spectacular success, actually, and that language has actually come as a result of people gathering all the information about what was it, maybe up to 10 or 12 languages in what we now call Tasmania, and creating this language, Palawakani, that is authentic, but it is created from, I guess that's a place where certainly the devastation of people and language was pretty terrible, horrific.
Yeah, interesting, Peter. Yeah.
Well, I'd recommend this movie to every Australian, and especially every Tasmanian should see it. It's an absolute triumph. It's going to, you know, there'll be some pushback in Tasmania, I think, towards certain aspects of it. It's very graphic, but it's a story that really is way overdue, and I'd recommend it to anybody who is weighing up what how they'll spend their money at the pictures. Go and see the nightingale if you can see.
Good on you, Peter.
And Palawa means person, Aboriginal person, and Kaurna language.
Yeah, there has been a revival in Tasmania, hasn't there? And particularly a revival in trying to reclaim place names as well. So that's existed in Australia for a while. I don't know whether it's increasing. By and large, the usage Uluru I think is pretty mainstream now, isn't it? As opposed to Ayers Rock, maybe.
And the Geographical Names Board in New South Wales is very active. They've now appointed a person to work, Aboriginal woman to work specifically on working with communities to find geographical place names so that places can be dual named if they've already got a name on them, or to have their Aboriginal name restored. So that's a very active exercise. Mount Warning, for example, is Wallumbean in New South Wales. And around Sydney, we've got about 17 place names around Sydney Harbour that are dual named.
In lots of instances, it would seem to make a lot more sense. Carta Judah, for example, as a replacement for some long forgotten Belgian princess, I think it was.
Olga's. Yeah, that's right. Olga.
It does seem. Yeah. Anyway, Jackie, hi.
Hi, I've got a question for Professor Troy. It's a little bit off topic. It's just I worked with Indigenous people for a while, and obviously people who are older than I, older than I was, the women you called auntie and the men you called uncle, as a sign of respect. Mm-hmm. But I found, just before I was leaving, so I was with this group of people for 2 years, I was told that there was someone I should have been calling auntie the whole time. And I'd always assumed she was a lot younger than I was. So I was horrified that nobody had said it beforehand. And, you know, we got on very well and things, that it was her sister who told me, and we were good friends, but it was she waited until I was about to leave to tell me. And I just thought, well, how in the future will I know if someone, should I just default? If I'm not, should I just default to auntie and uncle and they'll make fun of me if I get it wrong? I can say, how old do you think I am?
No, it's not an age thing. It's a respect term, as you said. And I think you just take your lead from the community. And if you hadn't been using that term all that time and no one had pulled you up, it's probably out of respect for you that they let you know, because you're obviously part of the community now, one way or another.
Okay. I was just, thank you very much. I was just wondering.
It's a sign of respect to you too.
Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you.
Good on you. Bye-bye. One of my texters says, do you have any words for numbers?
Does
Aboriginal English use numbers? In the same way that English would use numbers.
Well, we're really economical. there are few. So in Sydney, it's Woggle is one, Bulla is two, and Murray is a lot. And in a lot of Australian languages, that's pretty much how it works. So there was not a great need for counting.
A need for the word number 19, for example.
No, not in the same way that I guess in the Western kind of world we care about these things. But it doesn't mean that we didn't have a sense of quantity or vastness or weight. It's just that we did things differently.
Toby, hello.
Oh, hi. Toby Metcalf from Perth.
Hi.
Thank you for your program, Philip, and also for the wonderful contributions of your two guests. I met today with two wonderful Noongar people in Perth. They're involved in renewal programs in Noongar language and culture. Rita Lusted is one, and the other is Gary Smith. Rita is about to commence a Noongar program at Murdoch University. So in all our universities, there is some good activity in the area of language and culture. But what I was taking down to her were copies of an illustrated dictionary of the Southwest Aboriginal language. So it's just a small book, but it's into its sixth edition. And there is a proliferation of renewal programs down in Perth and in the Southwest. About 35 years ago, I did a survey when I was with ECU. We found about half a dozen fluent speakers of Noongar. There are a lot more, I'm sure. But now there are so many and so many centres where Noongar is being taught. So it's just encouraging that there is so much renewal work going on in these areas. And we have such wonderful people here who are heading this the renewal of Noongar.
Mm. Noongar is a spectacular success, and I love that Kylie Bracknell's even translating Shakespearean pieces into Noongar. So look out, we'll be colonising English next.
Yeah, Noongar is such a strong language in terms of the work that's being done and for revival, reawakening. It's really an impressive survival story.
Thanks, Toby. Yeah. Good on you.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you, bye-bye. What would be the is there a, not the dominant, that's the wrong term because of what we'd have been discussing about where the languages arose and what their associations with the country were. Mm. What's the most commonly spoken active Aboriginal language?
Well, if you define Creole as an Aboriginal language, it's Creole.
It would be Creole.
Absolutely.
This it's is the Creole by, across Northern...
The Creole across the Northern Territory. It's spoken by around 20,000 to 30,000 people, and it's incredibly strong, spoken across an area the size of Spain.
Hmm.
And for somebody who hasn't ever heard it or spoken it before, when you first hear it, you wouldn't know it was related to English in any way.
Because it's not... You don't understand it.
You wouldn't understand it.
No. But it's a mixture of what? Aboriginal words?
Well, it's mostly English-derived vocabulary, but the grammatical structure is a lot like Creoles in other countries as well. There's just something that happens in the process of creolization that tends to produce particular types of structures. And then there's some words from traditional languages and some words. And
well, so, I'd like to jump
you
in.
You want to disagree with me?
No,
this is actually that area of active debate in linguistics.
I wouldn't disagree. I'd just say that actually the first pidgin in the Pacific, creolized was the one that developed in New South Wales right from the very start when England first came here in 1788. So I think it's more the case that whatever went on there, and there's a lot of influence from the local Aboriginal languages, not just the Sydney language, has influenced the development of these. Why they look similar is because they've come from this development in the southeast of Australia. So
that's true for the English-based Creoles, but what I'm saying is that Creoles across the world, including the Spanish-based ones, the French-based ones, there's some structures that you tend to find again and again.
Yeah. Right, I want you to have this conversation back in the staff room. Where are we? John, hello. G'day, John.
Hey, how's it going?
Not bad.
I've done a little bit of travelling around Australia in the early days, and it's actually blown me away the way that the Indigenous cultures still have similarities in the way they refer to the white people just in general. That's one of the common words that I actually used to pick up. I'm a Maori, personally, expat from New Zealand, grew up here. Or brought over here when I was 9. And when I hit about, I think it was about 25, I started backpacking and traveling around. So I grew up on the Gold Coast. So I had a lot of Aboriginal friends from northern New South Wales and southern Queensland. And they always referred to the white people as Gubbies. When I was in my mid-20s, I started backpacking. I ended up in Kununurra. And the traditional owners referred to the white fellas as Gadiers, which I thought, well, that's a big difference, which is a big difference to what I thought they were, which, you know, I just wanted to learn what they were referring to. And, you know, it took me a while to get used to their lingo and such. And then after that, in my 30s, I ended up right at the top end of Weipa. And they referred to them as Gubba as well. And it just spun me out because I just saw like a sort of a curve in the language changing, like similarities, but the distance sort of changed. Kind of the same way that English changes over distance. Yeah, then accents and such, and it just blew me away. It's like, well, it's not that different. It's just distance that is changing the enunciation, perhaps.
Okay, yeah, well, let's put it back. You're rubbing your chin here, Rachel.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that there's really more than just changes in pronunciation that make differences from place to place in Australian First Peoples languages. Like the difference between some of the languages in the Northern Territory and the language down here is as big as the difference in, say, Hindi to English, right? There might be a historical relationship, but they're really, really different languages. But what you're probably noticing when you pick up on a word that sounds similar in different places is sometimes that word actually got... it travelled around. We have words that we call travelling words, Wanderwörter, that get borrowed from one place to another because they're convenient words and people move around and migrate and they take words with them. So even though the languages themselves can be really different, you can have a handful of words that are the same right across and maybe with different pronunciations, as you point out, because they get assimilated into the local languages.
So with the word for non-Aboriginal person, we often hear this word white now, Wadjala or white fella or something, and that that's one of those words that travelled from the Sydney area, but it never meant white as in the colour of the skin, or it was just a term that came from the way in which the British talked about the Irish. So the Irish who were beyond the pale of Dublin were black, and the ones who were within the pale were light and white and good. So those terms came to Australia from the way in which the British talked about the Irish and had nothing to do with skin colour. It was you were either in or out. If you were good, you were white. If you were bad, you were black.
And there it goes. There it goes. There was a simpler... Yes, all right. Alan, hello.
Hello. Turn the radio down.
Yep. Yeah, turn it down, Alan, and we can all...
The double word thing, like wogga wogga, gin gin, etc. And apparently gimpy is named after the stinging plant, the gimpy gimpy. And what's the double thing mean?
What's going on with the double thing?
It really just increases things. So back to our question about counting, it makes it more or many or increases something. So the word wogga wogga is from the word wakra wakra, meaning crows. Like, it's just the noise of the crow. So that's the noise they make, this wakra wakra noise. So
it's really just repeating the sound.
Yeah, it is. So some of it's what we call onomatopoeia. It's the sound of birds. A lot of those bird calls are reduplicated, but... it also means to increase things as well.
Gympie, right, which is the name of the town named after Gympie Creek because the Aboriginals, said the place was called Gympie or Gympie Gympie after the stinging plant, it apparently is bad, bad, really bad.
Or a lot of stinging plants.
There's a lot of stinging plants. That's it. That's interesting. All right, there. Thanks for raising that, Al. Good on you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's right. I think the beach in the south of Sydney called Coogee is actually Coogee Coogee, isn't it?
Stinky,
which is smelly, smelly, stinky because of the sea, the rotting seaweed seaweed there as well. Yeah, we've got time for one more quick call. Stephen, you'll have to be quick.
Hello. Oh, yeah. I just got another observational story about the word for white man. The ladies may be able to check the veracity of it. I've done a couple of stints in Aboriginal communities in Arnhem Land, and apparently they had the name for white man, Balanda, even before they ever saw one, because there was a... in one of those communities, there was a tamarind seed which came from Southeast Asia, but apparently there was some trading with the Malaccans. And in more recent years, when steel products started coming through and the indigenous people said, where did this come from? And it was Hollander, because it was the Dutch. The Dutch Indies.
Stephen, we're going to have to get some comment because we are up against a bit of a time constraint here. Yeah, but Rachel, you're...
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a lot of trade between... it may not have been the Macassans exactly, or who we call the Macassans today, but that part of Indonesia and northern Australia, and we've got lots of words in Australian traditional languages from that region.
We could go on all night. It's such a fascinating topic. It really is. I do thank you for your time. Dr. Rachel Hendry is a linguist at the University of Western Sydney. And we've also been joined by Professor Jacqueline Troy, linguist at the University of Sydney. Did I say you were from Sydney?
You
I'm
did.
In Western,
Western. Ah, Western. Western Sydney. Thanks, University.
Rachel. There we go.
Good to have you on board.
You two can fight it out.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.